if the cash flow is there, if it hits certain thresholds, certain numbers, it's solid. It's where it needs to be. And then secondarily, okay, if the doomsday scenario comes, what can we sell? What can we take back? What can we do ever?
Welcome back to the Millennial Dentist Podcast, a podcast all about working smarter, not harder. Pushing dentists to go beyond dental school dentistry and build the practice of your dreams. Here is your host, the millennial dentist himself, Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. As you see, I have a guest. Well, you may not see this because you may still be listening. I'm telling y'all, go check it on YouTube. What you're also going to notice is that my face is not washed out anymore because I have professional lighting. So I'm very excited about that. It's technically demo professional lighting, but soon enough, this place is going to be really looking good. So hopefully you enjoy that and you like that. Really excited about today's episode. You know, we've been kind of not bringing on as many guests. So Jesse, you're kind of, this is a big deal that you're coming on.
I'm excited.
But I am been wanting to bring more guests on as we kind of continue to expand the podcast. And it's like a reboot for me.
All right.
I was down for, I took the better half part of 2022 off. So last year I kind of got back into it. And so it's kind of like a reboot. We're like 50 episodes and 30 episodes into the reboot.
I'm glad to be a part of the reboot.
I love that. So anyways, without further ado, let me introduce Jesse. Jesse with First Citizens Bank. Welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you, man. Excited to be here. Excited to check in with your listeners and watchers, and we'll see what happens today.
Yeah, it'd be fun. We're going to talk about acquisitions. I think this is a super important topic, something that obviously a lot of people go through. It's usually something you go through once, maybe twice, or if you're into buying a practice, you go through it a lot. But it's definitely like a big topic, and it's something I hear a lot about is like, how do you even go on about that? So super excited about talk about acquisitions today. Before we jump into that, I have to remind you that this podcast is sponsored by myself. Because of that, I can talk about whenever I want. And so I will tell you that we'd love to see you at our 3D Growth Summit in May, I think 2nd and 3rd in Nashville, Tennessee. Tickets are going quickly. So if you want to get involved, come check that out. We would love to have you there. I'm thinking about doing a round off back tuck this year.
Oh boy.
I did a round off last year.
I can't wait.
So that is something that you may, if that interests you, then let me know. It's like one of those things where I'm going to have to start training.
It interests
now.
Me. So, I'll be there.
So yes, you will. So I need to get some feedback from people if that's something that I need to actually put forth some effort in. And then if I get enough likes, then I'll go forward the effort.
Okay. I'm going to solicit all my friends to go like.
Yeah, go like
so
that.
You have to do it.
We'll put that on an Instagram post. All right, let's jump into it. Jesse, tell the listeners a little about your background, and then we'll jump right into the acquisition conversation.
Sure. Very briefly, 20-plus year career in the banking finance industry. For the last, I guess, dozen years or so, heavily involved in the dental world, whether that be the real estate financing, building a practice, acquiring a practice, the equipment, lines of credit, everything that's involved in that.
Yeah, all things dental.
All things dental. Probably for, like I said, the last dozen years or so, it probably represents about 50% of my portfolio. And so, yeah, and then for this, we partnered recently, began partnering recently with 3D. Excited about that and excited about just continuing to communicate with your folks on 3D. And we've hit it off very well, and we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, that's something we're super excited about. You know, what Jesse's referring to is we've brought him in to be kind of an advocate for all of our dentists and our business coaching programs and other stuff that we do at 3D Dentist. So he's now doing some, you know, you're kind of doing a lot of work with getting in there and kind of peeling back the onion a little bit of what they've got going on. And that's been a really great resource. So we're super glad to have you in that regard. Well, let's jump right into it. Gosh, you know, my path was probably a little different just because I came out winning with dad, and then knew that, like, okay, well, this is, I guess, the practice I wanted to buy.
Yeah.
I didn't really, I guess, look at other places. Maybe I should have.
You didn't do a lot of shopping.
I didn't do a lot of shopping, but that's obviously not a reality.
Sure.
And what we're seeing more and more of is that dentists are coming out of school, and I think the challenge we have is they don't know what to do. Like, sure. They come out with all these loans. Maybe they don't think they can buy a practice.
Sure.
They're not ready. Let's first talk about what you all look at and see from just an industry standard as far as like, it seems like more people are going into corporate or group practices. What is your mindset, I guess, as from a banking perspective of what you all see with just dentist acquiring practices at an earlier age, like earlier in your career? Because it used to be you graduated and you bought a practice.
Yeah. You grew well. The cost was much lower, so that those challenges, the cost of school is much higher now. You know, so when folks come out right now, you know, students are coming out, like you mentioned, the corporate path. The biggest thing that I would advise even in that part, assuming you're wanting to own a practice at some point down the road, is even when you're going to that, spend the few extra bucks to have an attorney review your contract.
Yeah.
Some of the hurdles that I see on that end prior to acquisition, they're ready to acquire. They want to be in X area and come to find out they're locked in. There's
some
non-compete. There's non-compete that's much further than they expected. So just having it, don't assume that, you know everything in this contract and it's where you want it to be. So have somebody review that. That being said, from a sheer banking standpoint, a couple of things that we want to see or maybe don't want to see. I'll frame it this way. You all coming out of school, you have what we call the piece of paper that's a license to make money. You can have a very, very good living if you choose to go that path. And so we put a lot of weight into that.
Yeah.
We really do. Because you have that license, we love the dental world. We think it's good. It's low loss rate. Low default rate in the banking industry. So that being said, what happens is in some cases I see someone's been out of school for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. They've gone from making no money and spending money on school to now making $250,000 a year.
Right.
You know, even as an associate.
Yeah.
And so the worst thing that you can do is come out and buy your dream car, buy your dream home. And that's probably the biggest hurdle that I see people come in. They come in with all this debt from day one, and they're going in, and now that practice has to roll from day one, you know.
So you want to see more savings?
Not even necessarily savings, just not as much debt. Yeah, savings would be good, absolutely. If you're making $250,000 and you come to me 3 years after you got out of school, even with your student debt, which we recognize those costs have gone up,
right?
You know, but yes, you should have savings. And I'm not saying live off beans and rice, and I'm not saying don't enjoy yourself. You've earned the right to do that, but don't go out and buy $1,500, have a $1,500 a month car payment, and buy a $1.2 million home,
right?
Just because you can.
So when y'all look at like just the analytics of this, is the practice more important or is the buyer more important?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Expound on that.
Okay. So the practice itself, obviously, we're cash flow, back in the day, before my time, banking was primarily a collateral driven industry. And collateral is still very important. But now it's
meaning that the practice was more important than the buyer.
Well, not even the practice, just in general.
I see what you're saying.
Whatever you're
lending on, not just digital.
I need something to go take. And
that's how it works.
And repossess if I need to. You know, where it's over the last 20 plus years, it's emerged and converted over to primarily about cash flow. You know, if cash flow is there, if it hits certain thresholds, certain numbers, it's solid. It's where it needs to be. And then secondarily, okay, if the doomsday scenario comes, what can we sell? What can we take back? What can we do ever? Obviously, in the dental industry, I can't do a lot with some used dental equipment. So we're putting a whole lot into the person, as you asked, and the practice. But the practice, to answer your question, is the primary thing. But the person, I'm going to want to look them in the eyes and know that, you know, they're serious about what they're about to do. You know, they're not just signing up for another paycheck or ownership. Are they going to, you know, flake out? Or are they going to back up? Yeah, both are important.
And then, with that being said, like, what's the current standard? Because, like, when I bought my half, like, it was zero down.
Yeah.
Like, they just give you the money, and then, you know, you're kind of tied to them for a while. Is that still kind of the way it is? And that's why I get a little bit into the savings question, because it's like, the savings part is more of what y'all like to see just from a standpoint of, like, discipline, probably.
Sure.
Than like, the need to have money, because in theory, it's going to be 0% down or a low percent down, correct? That's still the main way it's done?
Correct. For the acquisition part, it's going to be 100% financing. However, what we refer to as the savings, what we're calling that is what I was talking about a minute ago.
On the personal side.
On the personal side, I don't have collateral to go take. If you go in and you buy a practice, and let's say it's doing $1 million a year, and through attrition, because everybody thought Dr. A, who sold it to you, was the best thing since sliced bread, and you lost 15% from day one just through attrition because they don't like your personality and they move on. Well, that savings is what we call a secondary source of repayment. If you get a little upside down, even hit a speed bump, hey, yeah, you have a backup source to pay your payment when the practice can't. So that's really what that's about. Liquidity is very, very important. Any part of lending, whether it's a dental practice, real estate, whatever, you know, banks want to see liquidity.
So now let's talk about on the practice side, what is an ideal, what is the ideal practice to buy from like a bank? Like when you look at it like, oh, this is a good one. We feel really strong about this. So maybe if I have a weaker person, I like, this is a good practice to buy.
One that cash flows very well. I mean, it's that simple. We're not going to.
And cash flow, I want to dumb this down because that's a word you use.
Sure.
I got very frequently. Yeah. Not that. What does that mean?
So cash flow would be after all expenses, all debt, we want to see you, and this is a round number. It can change depending on if it's a specialist involved or whatever, but we want to see 125% available for debt. So after debt service, including debt service, 125%, that's the cash flow. So in essence, there's a 25% above all debt service, all expenses that's available post month, every month, you know, that's excess.
So if the practice that let's use an example, because I think that will make it more. So if the practice does $100,000 in collections or you give me an example.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just use, if you want to say a round number, let's say your payment was after all expenses, your
$10,000 a month.
Yeah. And understand we look at it globally too, because you're typically in an acquisition standpoint, it's not four people come in and there's this major partnership. It's typically one doc
coming in. Yes.
So for us, we're looking at globally. We're throwing in the global cash flow. That would be your house payment, your everything.
Okay. Yeah. So you're looking at all the debt service.
We have to, because if that's kind of back what we were talking about a minute ago, if you got this major lifestyle outside, but you buy this little small practice that's doing X and you've got more going out the door over here that can even cover this, then we're all in trouble.
So you are looking at a good bit at what on the personal, because I didn't know how much that's separated. Like what's my personal life versus my, like your business stuff.
Well, again, unless you have a side gig.
Yes.
Pay for the personal.
Okay. That makes sense. So you're looking at 125% is going to include essentially the total debt service of all that stuff.
It's everything. Yeah, we're going to look at it globally. Yep.
So if someone has, let's just make up some numbers here. So let's say they have a $6,000 mortgage or $5,000 mortgage. Is that maybe a better one?
Let's say it this way. If simple math, let's say between your practice, your personal, everything, because in our calculations, before we even do that, we've already basically said, hey, we're going to account for X amount in spending, your groceries, your gas.
Okay.
We're just doing that in a lump sum.
Yep.
So it's literally going to be your debt service.
Okay.
Your car payment, your house payment, credit cards.
Yep.
Over here, the practice, let's put it all in and say it's $20,000 a month total. So we're talking about $240,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So 125% of that is what it's going to be.
And that needs to be before the doctor's paid. All overhead.
No, that's all. Yeah, correct.
The doll overhead, that it doesn't include the one owner doctor.
Correct. Whether that be through distributions, whether it be through.
You don't care necessarily how they're doing that as long as there's profit to that.
Gotcha. Yeah. We're going to give them credit for all that.
No, that makes sense. So I guess so that makes sense. So the cash flow of the business is important because ultimately you're looking at it on how that all.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess that's not interesting. That makes total sense. But that is something that I guess most people aren't doing the math like that. They're looking more like, is the practice worth $1 million or $1.5 million? So at the end of the day, that's somewhat irrelevant. Like if it's a $2 million practice, the cash flows versus a $1 million practice, y'all are.
But what makes it? So here, this question I would pose you in your mind or in the industry's mind, what makes it a one? Who determined it was a $1 million or a $2 million practice? You know what I mean?
You're talking about from a valuation standpoint.
So here would be my thing. If you have an opportunity to know, you don't, all things being equal, you walk in and I've got a $2 million practice here, top line.
Yep.
And it's making, let's say it's making $500,000 a year. It's netting. After everything, it's netting $500,000 a year. Or I've got a $1.5 million practice over here that's netting $550,000 a year.
Yeah.
Which one do you want? You know,
But, well, I guess I have to look at the expenses because then I want to know if I can clean up that, like if there's,
correct,
you know, but yes, but face value, you're absolutely right. I'd rather have the 1.5 that spits more money out than doing the, yes, absolutely.
And there a lot of valuations are, you know, it's.
Let's talk about valuations because traditionally valuations of dental practices, like up until I feel like the last couple of years, were always done some percentage of previous year's collections. Is that, and now it seems like it's moving more to like EBITDA and all that. Is that, are you seeing that change, or is it still kind of both? Or
it's both, but full disclosure, like from my standpoint, from my's, the valuations in the industry are more for the buyers and sellers. It's like I don't put a lot of weight in that value. That cash flow worksheet is going to tell me if it's worth me lending X amount of dollars to that person who's,
so if that works, you don't really care if it's overvalued or undervalued per se, because the,
I mean, yeah, I mean, if they're paying to, yeah, if they're over, if it's overvalued,
yeah, because if they're overvalued, if it's overvalued though, then most likely they're going to have a cash flow potential challenge,
probably. And what I'm using it for personally is the details they put in there, the staff, the salaries, the equipment, the date, you know.
Yeah, so let's move into that then. So when you look at like, okay, what kind of practice do I want to buy? When you're obviously looking at that stuff from a standpoint of like strategic too, of like, hey, this is a good value, or I have less risk here.
Sure.
What do you see dentists think they want to buy versus what you think they should buy? Like, talk a little bit about that.
I think it comes down to, one, what is their appetite, and truly deciding what do you want to walk into from day one. And, you know, use the word think they want to buy. That's probably one of the biggest things, excuse me, that I see in the industry is they want the shiny, nicest.
They want brand new, they want nice equipment.
Everything. Well, you're going to pay for it. You know, if I look at, like, if I look at a practice, I'm a dentist and I want to buy a practice. If I look at a practice and I'm like, okay, this guy is killing it, or this lady's killing it, whoever's selling the practice, and they are a production machine, I'm going to look at their individual production. Whether it's them, the associate, whoever, their
seller, the seller.
The seller.
Yes.
And their production machine. Well,
do a 1.5 million.
Whatever. Do I have to decide if I'm going to pay this, am I going to come in and work at the pace they're working?
Oh, or, I agree.
Or do I want the practice that I'm looking and there is so much low hanging fruit? They're sending, they're referring their implants out, they're referring their cosmetic out, they're doing crowns and cleanings.
Yeah.
You know, but they have this massive database, you know, this clientele that they're sending everything out. Well, for me, I'm like, woof. I don't have to. I go in and with my expertise that I've just learned in school, and my C is this and my C is that.
Right.
And I can do all these things. Well, now I bring all these people under one roof and I don't let them go next door. I don't send them to the
You're going to immediately add value.
Immediately. And, you're adding cash flow.
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree because I see that too, that it's like people want to get the bigger practice, or like they're looking for something that they can do it. And my thing, I love that you said, like, can I step in and, I look at kind of, I guess, the opposite is, can I step in and fill their shoes? Like, do I have their skill set or their cup of tea to even do this type of dentistry? You know, like cosmetic practices are a good example where, you know, primarily if you've got strong, very cosmetic driven practices, those are built off a lot of the brand of that individual.
Sure.
And there's a good chance a lot of that dentistry has been done. So that means that there's a need for a constant new flow or funnel of patients that may or not be there, versus like what you said, a practice where maybe they've got a good base, but they're not doing, you know, as much potential as they can be because of the procedures that the provider's offering.
Yeah, and break it down from a math standpoint. Let's say, again, that high-end practice that is just, it's nice, and they're killing, and it's making money.
Yep.
It's a $2 million practice. And let's just say that they're doing, you know, the valuation or the agreement is 90% of previous year's collections, which is a good average. So you're talking about, you're going to buy that $2 million practice for $1.8 million. And you're going to maintain.
Whew, yeah.
Okay.
Talk about some pressure.
Or do I want the $750,000 practice, same description I said a minute ago, that's all this low-hanging fruit, that I know with my skill set in 18 months.
That's what I want to buy.
This can be a $1.8 million practice.
Is it the fear
that I bought it for $600,000 or $700,000?
Is the fear that they have to go in there? Because I get too, that like there's a fear of like, well, I've got to buy Cerec, that's 180 grand. I got to buy Combeam, that's another 60 grand. Like, I got to update the equipment. So I think, and maybe the math still checks out better, but that I think is the fear is like, if I buy the practice that's nicer, I've already got the equipment, but if I buy the 750 that's old and run down, now I gotta on some level add another $500,000.
Sure.
To that, to really make it what I want to be. Is that fair to look at it that way? Or is it
very fair? But then that's where you have to literally break down the math. Is it, or am I looking
because I don't think people do that
$10 difference, or am I looking at practice that's $100,000 difference?
Because today, if I were to like leave and go somewhere else, I would think, okay, here's a practice that's 800 grand, but to practice the way I want to practice, I need to add $300,000 in equipment. Then really the practice, I should think of it as a $1.1 million sure. practice versus maybe another practice that already has the equipment. Maybe that's a better way to kind of compare.
Absolutely.
You know, apples to apples, so to speak.
Absolutely. But you still have to do the math on the patient base. What's that mix look like?
Yeah, a procedures list is a great
huge
thing to look at.
It's a huge thing. It's based on your skill set and what areas you intend to practice in. That's going to be very important.
Now, the follow-up to that, or the message I also hear, which I talk a lot about, but I like to reiterate it when I see moments to reiterate it, is how you also need to think about this from a seller standpoint, in that if I'm a seller who's built a practice that's so reliant on me, it's a $2 million practice where I do $1.8 million with a really high skill set, how that can be a lot harder to sell than... Meaning like that I got a little bit of my work cut out for me because even though I built something that's really good, it's not like I can just turnkey sell the thing. Do you follow me?
I do. And where I know where you're going, but back to what I said a minute ago, there's always going to be that dentist that wants the bright and shiny.
So there's enough out there that so will
if you've got,
get suckered in.
It's not even getting suckered. It's what's your preference. There's someone, conversely, like even what I said a minute ago, and I might contradict myself a little bit, but there are going to be people, they don't want to think about even figuring out three additional pieces of
equipment. Yeah, I get that.
They want the turnkey, and it's a value to them.
Yeah.
And so somebody's going to make that decision. I can tell you this, and I can't speak to every market in the country, obviously, but the markets that I'm familiar with, if a practice goes on sale, I mean, it just the demand's there. And so as long as you're working with the right partner or, you know, maybe it's an associate that's buying in or buying out from within, or you're using a practice transition broker or whatever, you know, it's making sure you have the right, you're using, you know, the appropriate partners that know that have the connections on, hey, what's coming available, or they might even like a transition specialist, they're sitting there holding a book of a dozen people
right.
They know are looking right now and they know what they're looking for.
Do you advocate using like a practice transition type person or a agency or whatever they call them like that to have people find those things? And
I do if you don't have, like, if it's not from within.
Okay, so if you're going to acquire another practice, like if you're looking for a practice to acquire, that's a good way to do it.
If it's a cold transition, and a cold transition being there's no associate,
are those things more like, I guess my always fear of those looking out for like the buyer doctor is, are those not like somewhat, if I'm hiring a company like to broker this, are they not somewhat biased towards me, like as a seller?
Well, yeah, they can't represent both parties. And maybe I misunderstood you. Was your question was if I'm a seller, do I use a broker or if I'm a buyer?
Well, I guess both. Like, is there a benefit to a seller using?
Well, the buyer's not paying anything. The reason they want to use a find a broker is because the broker, and I'm sure
they can give them options.
They can tell them this is what's available. But from a selling standpoint, unless you have a warm transition, someone that's working for you,
there's not a lot of.
How are you going to sell?
I guess a rep or something. Yeah, there's not a good way to do that.
You're going to tell your buddies and just hope the right person
comes
along.
Comes in.
Yeah.
Well, let me transition the conversation then, because I have some follow up questions I then would have was, so I found a practice I want to buy. It falls in line with the stuff we talked about. It cash flows well. It's an area where I can potentially add some value out with new procedures and stuff like that. What makes Bank A different from Bank B? I mean, and obviously, like, I'm biased because, like, you did, you know, First Citizens did all of our land, real estate, building, and everything.
Sure.
But what does separate Bank A from Bank B from Bank C outside of, like, because we as the buyer just think interest rates.
Sure.
And that's kind of somewhat variable, and I get changes on the market and whatnot. But outside of that, what are the key things? Like, what is your unique selling proposition, I guess? Or what would a bank's unique selling proposition be?
Yeah, so your initial question, if let's say non-dental for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, it's most banks have their different appetites. You know, this group likes residential construction more than anything. This group likes
their niche.
Yeah, their niche. Us, we love dental, medical, and professional services. That's just not that we don't do other stuff, because we do, but that's just what we're good at.
Are there other players that are similar like that? Who would be competitors? Am I allowed to ask that?
I'm not saying that on here.
All right.
You're going to figure that out yourself.
Well, I know Bank of America's one, because they did mine a long time ago when I bought the first part of the practice. But
that's a great transition to the second part of your question. So whether it's Bank of America or whoever, and this is me, I can't speak, never worked for Bank of America.
No, absolutely. You can't speak to anybody else other than yourself.
So, but for me, to answer your question, this is what you're getting with me. You know, with Bank of, this is my cell phone.
So now, you have to tell some people.
Some people aren't. I'm sorry.
Not everyone's joined my YouTube movement.
I am currently holding my cell phone in the air.
Yes. People are still listening on their tractor or something.
Yeah, there you go. So for me, it's the relationship.
Okay.
And if you're looking for, I will tell a client up front, I had this conversation this past week. We put a sweetheart deal in front of them. The incumbent bank, their bank, who they had a long-term relationship, we blew them out of the water. And I explained to him, he's asking me, he said, how are you that much better? I just explained him some things about our balance sheet, different things like that from a competitive.
No, that was the same way with us. I mean, we had banked with somebody for a long, long time. And it was like, well, this isn't even in the same realm of ballpark.
So we did the same. I had the same conversation. So next question to me, he said, well, because I explained to him, it's because it's the full relationship. That's part of what the fact, you know, your deposits come over, everything else. And he asked me, he said, well, can you give me the option without the full relationship, you know, adjust my rate or whatever? And I said, no, I can't.
Right.
You know, my answer would be is we're not the right fit. If you're looking for a transaction, we're not going to be the right fit. And this kind of leads into the future.
Oh, I understand what you're saying there. And like meaning that it's not a one-time transaction. No. Like on some level, a house is a one-time transaction.
Correct. The biggest complaint that I hear, like within, say, the equipment reps and things like that, and even it is like trying to get, they want to buy this new piece of equipment. Well, they're having to go through this full underwriting somewhere because they want this $100,000 piece of equipment. Well, it's because they haven't had a relationship. You know what I mean? If whether it's a sheet of paper you're filling out with a finance company or it's a bank or whatever, you're starting over every time you need something. A new building, you're shopping all over again, you're trying to interview, you're figuring things out, as opposed to, hey, Jesse, this is what I need.
Yeah.
I've got your stuff always updated. We're communicating. I'm seeing you on a regular basis. I'm not building your building or financing your practice and we never see each other again.
Yeah.
I'm going to see you on your birthday. I'm going, whatever that looks like, you know, we're going to see each other. It's a relationship.
Well, and I guess my point is, I think it's good to outline what that means. I think you're doing a job there, just because I hear that the more I get into this, the more I understand relationship. But I also say that generally speaking, our generation is not as, we're more transactionally driven.
Sure.
When it comes to a lot of these services and different things.
Sure.
Maybe what we are is we're still relational, but like it's relational, but with a little bit of like jaded view of you, or the industry at large. Whereas I feel like my dad's generation was a little more just like, it was just, if I have a good relationship, you could sell me a load of shit and I wouldn't, I guess is what I'm getting at.
So I'll piggyback. I get what you're saying, but here's the thing. And whether somebody listened to this or they find out the hard way or whatever, about the average is about the 3-year mark after they bought the practice and they use a transactional bank. Might have got a great rate. That's fine. They need something. They're trying to figure out and they're like, I can't get anyone on.
Yeah, or when something doesn't go as well. Like I think a good point where I'll notice is like obviously COVID was a very telltale of this, right? Because like when we went into that situation, at the end of the day, most everybody jumped on the bandwagon of like helping, like bank speaking wise, like pause loans, did things. But that wasn't like how it initially started.
Sure.
Like it was very much like the people that had good relationships, I think those banks like immediately reached out and were like, hey, we're going to get through, we'll all get through this. Whereas like there was a lot of uneasiness with people who didn't have those of like what's going to happen or not going to happen. So I definitely see and advocate that like there's value. Luckily, I haven't had to be like, hey, I need a favor, or, you know, hopefully I don't have to do that, but hopefully you'll be there.
I'll always be there.
Cheers for that, man.
Cheers.
Cheers to that. Well, this has been good. I'd like to have you on some level of, you know, I think these are good topics. If you've got questions that relate to the kind of these specific topics, where you want to just get direct access to somebody, shoot them to me. I'm happy to bring Jesse back on. And we've kind of talked about maybe doing this a little, you know, every so often to kind of talk specifics of things that I don't necessarily know the answers to get some insight on. So I appreciate you coming on and doing this. If you've got specific questions and want to reach out to Jesse, what's your information? How can people get in touch with you?
My cell phone. I'll just give it to you.
Oh, that's nice.
615.
I'll put this on Tinder or something.
No, please don't do that. My wife would not be happy about that. I've been happily married for 20. How many years am I going on this year? A long time.
A long time. That's,
yeah. So, no, please don't do that.
Well, I won't do that, but keep
615-924-2988. 615-924-2988. And
if they're intimidated to call you, what's your email?
Jesse, J-E-S-S-E. Lee@firstcitizens.com. Jesse.Lee@firstcitizens.com. First Citizens is
I'm sure that'll get put in the show notes by somebody. I don't know who does that, but we've got somebody that does that. So, well, dude, I appreciate it. This was fun. And
you can follow me on Instagram.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yes, you got to plug it, dude. You got to fight for it. Tell them about your Insta name.
At The Dental Banker.
Let's go. Let's go. I love that. I mean, I think that was great. At The Dental Banker. And you better be following me at Millennial Dentist. And everybody work smarter, not harder. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.